on case 83622, Aldape v. State. Counsel, will you state your appearances, please? Thank you. All right, thank you. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right, excellent. Counsel Justice Perry is participating from Carson City via video. Justice Herndon is not participating in this matter.
Thank you.
All right. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, please. With your Honor's permission, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The First Amendment protects citizens' rights to engage in public discourse, to speak and listen, and then after reflection, speak and listen once more. Access to public forums where these conversations are held is fundamental to this right. This case is about a standard probation condition for all persons convicted of a sex offense that blanketly prohibits engagement in the forum that has become one of the most important places to exchange views, the internet. Packingham v. North Carolina recognized that cyberspace is modern society's town square. Today, the internet serves as the majority of Americans' primary medium for communication, and the highest First Amendment protections must be afforded. Because NRS 176A.410 subsection Q is a content-neutral restriction like the restriction analyzed in Packingham, intermediate scrutiny applies.
Let me ask you a question. On Packingham, you're talking about sex offender registrants subject to this bar, we'll say. Here, you're talking about probationers. Is there any, for your purposes, any analytical difference in how we should approach the First Amendment rights of a probationer who's being supervised and people in Packingham?
Your Honor, the Packingham court did not make a distinction or specifically say that its analysis was only relevant for people who were post-custody, having a post-custodial status. There's been much discussion about that point in the briefings. However, the only reason the U.S. Supreme Court brought up his post-custodial status was to mention that it was not being considered by the court. Therefore, the intermediate scrutiny analysis for public forums that was discussed in Packingham should apply here. While the rights of our probationer...
Wouldn't you agree that, I mean, the rules are a little different for someone who's on probation versus someone who has completed their sentence?
Sure, Your Honor. It is accepted that a probationer's fundamental rights are not absolute. However, no case law suggests that a probationer completely forfeits all of his First Amendment rights. For example, under the United States versus Saltero case from the Ninth Circuit, the court noted that restrictions infringing on fundamental rights of probationers are reviewed carefully. The federal courts that have examined probation conditions infringing on constitutional rights, such as Saltero and Wells, have applied narrow tailoring. They have examined whether there is a reasonable relationship to the government's goals and that the restriction does not burden substantially more fundamental rights than necessary to achieve those goals. And here we have a very different situation where we have a statute that fails on its face because subsection Q mandates that the district court impose a restriction on all internet access without requiring a district court judge to make fact-specific findings that a particular individual's case or offense was even related to internet use. In the federal cases, in order for there to be a ban on internet use, the judges have first had to make a finding that the internet was essential or integral to the offense. Subsection Q in Nevada applies to all sex offender probationers regardless of case facts. Many cases, if not most, involving a sex offense, including this case, have no relationship to the internet whatsoever. Completely banning internet access for these probationers burdens far more speech than necessary to achieve any government purpose. It restricts individuals' ability to read the news, to engage in family communications, submit job applications, engage in employment communications, even look at product reviews. This subsection even restricts access to owning a smartphone, the primary device in today's world for communication.
Counsel, let me inquire, because the probation term signed by Judge Johnson in number 15, so you can't possess an electronic device capable of accessing the internet and not access the internet through any such device or any other means, unless possession of such a device or such access is approved by the parole and probation officer assigned to the defendant. So is that temporary ban until you meet with your probation officer? I guess, do we have to see kind of what happens? I mean, does this need to play out a little bit before we determine what if uniformly when they come in, they go, okay, we just want to know what phone you're using. We want to know what laptop you're using. Where are we in that process? Or you're just saying 15 is just bad?
Your Honor, the narrow tailoring has to be done up front by the sentencing judge. The prosecution argues that the restriction here is not absolute because probation officers have discretion to grant exceptions. And while courts have approved of a probation officer's ability to grant exceptions, courts uniformly reject the argument that this is a cure for a lack of narrow tailoring up front. The district courts are the ones equipped to do the constitutional analysis to ensure that the restrictions on a probationer are narrowly tailored. Probation officers don't have the capacity to make those restrictions in an equitable and consistent manner. Additionally, the state argues, as Your Honor suggested, that the finiteness of the restriction indicates that it is narrowly tailored. However, there's no case law suggesting that a time limit on a restriction is sufficient to constitute narrow tailoring. Instead, courts look to whether the restriction is specific in its restriction and its applicability, and it must be necessary to achieve a government interest. Your Honors, the district court also erred by imposing the probation condition under subsection M for two reasons. First, the plain language of the statute limits the condition to Tier 3 offenders. Second, subsection M restricts access to a First Amendment public forum, a traditional public forum. But here there was no nexus between Mr. Aldape's access to the public forum and the facts of his underlying case. As to the first argument, the plain language of the statute reads that it applies only to Tier 3 offenders. And this is the portion of the statute restricting access to traditional public forums like parks and theaters, which was imposed in this case. Yes, there is a statute giving a judge broad discretion to impose reasonable probation conditions, but when a specific statute uses words that specifically limit the court's discretion to impose that condition, the specific must control over the general. And it makes sense here. It's a reasonable interpretation that the legislature intended the most severe restrictions to apply only to the most serious offenders.
Well, counsel, can I ask you that if that subsection M, it does require the imposition of the geographic restriction on Tier 3 offenders, but it doesn't prevent the court from imposing a restriction on the Tier 2 offenders, right?
So our position is that the language of the statute stating that it only applies to Tier 3 offenders means that the legislature intended for that subsection to be only applied to Tier 3 offenders, that the court would not have the discretion to apply that condition to Tier 1 or 2 offenders because it is so restrictive.
So, counsel, are you suggesting that the trial court only can impose the statutory conditions of probation at sentencing?
No, Your Honor. Of course, the district courts have discretion to impose conditions that it believes are reasonably necessary. However, if a condition substantially restricts or infringes upon a fundamental right, there must be a constitutional analysis. Or in this particular situation, if the legislature made a point for one particular probation condition to indicate that it was supposed to be only applicable to certain offenders, then the district court would not have the discretion to apply that condition. If this court finds otherwise and believes that the district court has the ability to impose that subsection M on any probationer, then we have an as-applied constitutional challenge to the way that it was applied in this case. There must be narrow tailoring because this restriction infringes on Mr. Eldape's rights. The ability to go to a park or a theater is fundamental to traditional First Amendment analysis.
Counsel, though, in terms of tailoring, I'm looking actually at Mr. Eldape's the imposed conditions. One is no contact with him, because the court did tailor this to Mr. Eldape. Right? There's not a 500-foot requirement in here on either of those. It's an 18-year-old, under 18, in a secluded environment is number 10. And number 11 is without approval. I'll just look at 1 and 3. Let's take out motion picture. But a playground, park, school, or a business that primarily has children as customers or conducts events that primarily children attend. Are you saying that the court can't tailor that type of condition without prior approval? So somebody like Mr. Eldape, who molested a child, can't have any sort of, this doesn't tailor to him specifically?
That is our position, Your Honor. The court did make findings that it believed that the condition was appropriate for Mr. Eldape. However, there was no nexus between the facts of this case, which involved conduct between with a member of the family related by marriage, which occurred within the home. There was no facts in this case that related to seeking out children in public or any attempt to lure a child from a public place. It's especially unnecessary for the court to have imposed the condition because, as Your Honor pointed out, there was a condition for Mr. Eldape to have no contact with minors under 18. That was a separate condition. So the imposition of the condition to stay away from public forums like parks and theaters is not necessary to achieve the government's purpose, and it was not narrowly tailored to Mr. Eldape's specific case.
Counsel, do you want to use the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, please. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Counsel.
May it please the court. Similar to every defendant that enters into a guilty plea, the state is also entitled to receive the benefit of its bargain. And to receive the benefit of its bargain in this case, that requires the dismissal of this appeal. That's the underlying principle that this court recognized in Burns v. State. And it's an important principle for public policy reasons, and there's three main reasons. The first is that a defendant gets great value from making concessions when it comes to appellate waivers. The second is that the government benefits from saving both time and money in litigating appeals. And the final is that society benefits when there is a finality to this judgment.
Counsel, may I ask, appreciating that, what about the fact that when the defendant makes the waiver, the defendant doesn't have the probation conditions in front of them? In fact, the probation conditions aren't always set out in open court, sometimes received subsequent to that hearing.
So that goes to the prospective nature of the appellate waiver. And in Burns v. State, the court ruled that prospective waivers were okay, adopting the analysis of both the Ninth and the Tenth Circuit. When you look at Burns v. State, what you see specifically was a waiver involving, and reasoning by the court involving the waiver to something that occurred at jury deliberations. So that is similar in this respect about something that has not occurred to this defendant. He has no idea what's going to happen at jury deliberations. And the court held that that was prospectively waived. And specifically, the claim for jury deliberations, if you read the appellate briefing in that case, was of the constitutional nature of a confrontation clause violation. So the prospective issue or the prospective nature of the claim was not a concern to the court in Burns v. State, and it is the entire purpose of these types of appellate waivers. Now,
so counsel, the guilty plea agreement sets forth that among the rights that are being waived under the waiver of rights section are the right to appeal the conviction with the assistance of an attorney, which makes sense. And it goes on, unconditionally waiving my right to a direct appeal of this conviction, and it goes on. So that makes sense, because by pleading guilty, you're saying, yes, I'm going to be convicted of this offense. But isn't the sentence different than the conviction, such that he arguably shouldn't be precluded from appealing an issue that comes up as a result of the sentence?
So I think the answer to that depends on how you evaluate the word conviction means. When you look at the statute 177.015, that is the statute that permits a defendant to appeal from a guilty plea agreement. So the language from that statute is the same stat language that appears in the guilty plea agreement, and the language refers to a final judgment. And when you look at what a final judgment is in terms of in terms of this kind of appeal, the final judgment is that judgment of conviction, which also by statute is required to include the sentence. So the interpretation that the state proposes of that language, conviction, would be to the challenge of the judgment of conviction.
So a conviction is equivalent to a judgment of conviction.
That's correct, Your Honor. That would be the language that the state puts forward. And when you look at certain, albeit unpublished, opinions by the Court of Appeals, that's the interpretation that they've adopted as well.
But is that fair to an ordinary reader of this plea agreement?
I believe so. And I think that aspect, that question goes more to whether it's knowing and voluntary, whether he knowing and voluntary waived that question, not whether the agreement itself, not whether the claim itself falls within the scope, which would be the second step of that analysis.
But if there's confusion, shouldn't that be construed against the state if it's not clear?
That is correct, that an ambiguous term would be construed against the state, Your Honor, but I think that this term is not ambiguous. Ultimately, though, if the court finds that it falls within the scope, the remaining analysis would be to look at whether it's knowing and voluntary, and then whether it constitutes a miscarriage of justice. When you look at the miscarriage of justice analysis, if the court makes it to that point, this type of claim is parallel to the one made in Holzer, the 10th Circuit case regarding probation conditions.
Let me ask you, counsel, would an unlawful sentence be outside the purview of the appellate waiver?
So an unlawful sentence, so the Holzer opinion both kind of describes what caused a miscarriage of justice. So that would go into the miscarriage of justice analysis. And when you look at an unlawful sentence, what you're looking at is whether there's a statutory permission for the court to do it. So, for example, let's say the statutory range was 1 to 10 years, and the court sentenced to 1 to 50 years. That would be clearly outside the district court's authority, and that would fall into that miscarriage of justice exception, giving an appellant the right to challenge that claim.
So, counsel, by that analysis, what you're saying is that it would be a problem for the judge to not follow the statute, but if the judge doesn't follow the Constitution, it's okay?
The claim is that, and it's the same analysis that was presented in Holzer, was that probation conditions do not constitute a miscarriage of justice. That bails do not fall within the statutory range. And when you look at the Ninth Circuit case, Wells, the reasoning for that was also similar. The only difference was that the Ninth Circuit takes a different approach to constitutional claims in the Tenth Circuit. But if the waiver in the Ninth Circuit was clear to constitutional rights, they also would have waived that claim. So that's the approach that's being taken by the courts that have adopted, or the courts that this court relied on to adopt this miscarriage of justice analysis. And that's the analysis the state would propose to adopt.
So I just want to understand the rule you're proposing. You're saying that if a condition of probation were unconstitutional, just assuming for the moment, that would not constitute a miscarriage of justice, that the defendant in question would have the opportunity to appeal.
That's absolutely correct, and that's what the Ninth and Tenth Circuit have held. And the reason for that is that once you start analyzing the underlying claim, you start to avoid the entire purpose of an appellate waiver. Because if the underlying claim is meritful...
Well, but we're talking about probation conditions. That's not about the underlying claim.
No, the underlying claim is that the appellant is claiming that the probation condition violates my right. So that's the underlying claim. And the moment you start to analyze that, there's really no purpose for the appellate waiver. And that's the, at least the public policy purposes start to disappear. And that's what the Ninth and Tenth Circuit have said in those cases. Now, moving on to the First Amendment challenge, specifically regarding the mandatory conditions. The thing that I would like to focus on is the standard, initially is the standard. And the problem with that is that the reason that when you look at that Wells decision, and then footnote 5, it says that reliance on Packingham is misguided. Because Packingham applies to, applied to post-custodial set of facts. So that's why we're not looking at intermediate scrutiny, strict scrutiny. We're looking at something different here. What they discussed, the standard was whether it's reasonably related to the goal of deterrence, protection of the public and rehabilitation, and whether you can, it's, and the tailoring is reasonably necessary without no greater deprivation. That's something other than what's discussed in Packingham. And there's a reason for that. The reason for that is that while the appellant is correct that a probationer does not entirely lose their constitutional rights, they are severely restricted.
Does that test help the state here where we have a condition that's statutory that's just applied in every single case without any analysis?
So that goes toward the overbreath portion of the claim. And the issue with that is that you still need to look, when you challenge a statute, the problem is that it's not, at least in reading the initial briefing, it was not entirely clear to me what sort of challenge was being levied. Was this a typical standard facial attack as the Supreme Court has described it, where you're saying there's no set of circumstances where this statute is constitutional? I don't think that's the case here. I think that from reading the Ninth Circuit opinions that the court's been provided by both the appellant, or by both the respondent and the appellant, that there are clear circumstances where internet conditions can be placed. So it does not fall into that standard category. The next is whether it's an as-applied claim specifically towards this appellant. And when you look at the type of activities that this appellant was engaging in, this is the type of person that internet restrictions need to apply to. This is a person who, throughout their criminal offenses, isolated a minor over multiple occasions and inappropriately and sexually touched that minor.
What does that have to do with having a cell phone or a laptop? I'm trying to figure out why this restriction is not being narrowly tailored to the circumstances of Mr. Aldafe's offenses. He didn't commit the crime using electronic devices, and it is a very restrictive thing to impose on someone when they can't get a job, but they can't communicate with their families, everything that counsel said over here.
So it's absolutely correct that his instance did not involve the use of an electronic device, but I don't think the analysis ends there. Because what you need to look at, and in its respondent's brief, there was some mention of the legislative minutes back from when this was initially passed regarding the fact that probation, parole and probation was having specific issues with sex offenders using the internet to commit new offenses, particularly child-based offenders. So when you look at that, and then you look at the concurrence in Packingham, you see a lot of concerning facts. You see the facts that basically presented that children use the internet in different ways that make them more susceptible to child offenders. That through their use of the internet, abusers are able to lure children. And given the
would there be some way of, isn't he already prohibited from having contact with minors? Like, isn't that a separate condition?
That is a separate condition, but the purpose is that there needs to be a way to prevent him from not just having physical contact with minors,
right,
but to having some type of contact with minors over the internet.
So can you just say don't have contact with minors over the internet instead of no use of the internet entirely?
Well, I don't think it's no use of the internet entirely. It's no use
That's
of the internet
says.
up. Well, what it says is that it's no use of the internet as, and then the conditions can be placed by parole and probation. And when you read the legislative minutes, they mention specifically the fact that they will consider things like employability and the nature and type of offender. Those are precisely the kinds of conditions.
None of that is in the statute, though. There's no guidance to the PO's discretion.
The guidance of that discretion would then be that the district court basically acts as a safeguard. If for some reason there is a specific type of claim.
If the statement in the statute is categorical, the offender may not possess any electronic device capable of accessing the internet. So if you go to a restaurant and you want to look on your cell phone for a menu, you can't do that.
Unless you were given the authority to do so by parole and probation, to use your phone for those, to have access to your phone.
Right. And what if they deny that? No. Yeah, what if the parole and probation officer says, you can't?
Then the district court acts as the safeguard that they can file a motion to then further allow them to do so. And the only thing the...
And if the court says no?
And if the court says no, then that's kind of, ultimately... There might be an avenue to appeal that decision.
But doesn't it have to be
legislative history? This statute was passed almost 25 years ago, right?
That's correct.
So your reliance on the legislative history is on reliance of the internet as it existed and cell phones as they existed at that time. And I understand that, the statute's still in place. But I think it's kind of faulty to rely on such outdated legislative history when the internet has changed so dramatically and has become so ubiquitous in people's ability to get around and, get an Uber or order a lunch or whatever.
If it's changed, it's changed in a manner that has allowed offenders to only further have access to children than it did 25, 30 years ago. So the whatever change there is, it would only really further support, and you can see in that Packingham concurrence all of the considerations that the court has when it comes to these offenders. The last thing before my time runs out, I want to mention has to do with this overbreadth analysis, and I briefly discussed that as applied, it would apply to this specific appellant. This court has previously ruled that it is manifestly strong medicine to invalidate a statute at the behest of someone who it applies to. And it's the state's position that it does apply to him. And based on that, the state would ask that the court affirm the judgment.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. A couple of points on rebuttal. Mr. Aldape did not waive his right to appeal an unconstitutional probation condition by pleading guilty. Mr. Aldape waived his right to appeal his conviction. Any waiver must be knowing and voluntary, and there's zero language in the guilty plea agreement that indicates that Mr. Aldape would be waiving the right to appeal an aspect of his sentence. As the court pointed out, the guilty pleas are drafted by the district attorney's office, and Mr. Aldape would not be in a position to make a knowing and voluntary waiver. That conviction, but also would mean sentence.
So is your argument that the GPA doesn't cover that waiver, or that it does, but it's not knowing and voluntary?
So, Your Honor, both. The guilty plea agreement does not cover sentence explicitly, and if it was intended to, there's no way that Mr. Aldape would be able to understand that. I also wanted to point out in the Wells case mentioned by the state, that there was a situation where a defendant explicitly waived the right to challenge, quote, any aspect of sentence, and the federal court nonetheless applied an exception for challenging an illegal sentence and specifically an unconstitutional condition of probation because the Constitution is the supreme law of the land.
What about the state's argument that the statute as applied to Mr. Aldape, it's an as-applied challenge, and that we shouldn't consider your facial argument because it does apply to him?
Is that with regard to subsection Q, Your Honor?
I believe
the internet condition?
I believe that's what the state was arguing, yes.
So, Your Honor, our challenge would be both on the statute's face and as applied. The statute on its face is unduly restrictive because it is a mandatory condition.
But can Mr. Aldape bring that argument because it does apply to him? I was getting the sense that the state was arguing that because it applied to him, that we shouldn't consider the facial challenge.
Well, Your Honor, the condition does not apply to Mr. Aldape. Simply because a case involves children doesn't translate to it involving the internet. In every federal case where a ban on the internet has been upheld, there has been a finding by the court that there was some internet use that was related to the offense. And under the test suggested by the state for probationers and restricting internet, the statute at hand would still fail. Because here,
is there anything in the record about requests for exceptions from probation officers and whether they are granted or anything about that in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. In the lower court did make mention that Mr. Aldape would be able to go to his probation officer to request an exception. However, as Amicus Counsel mentioned in its brief, the United States versus Lacoste case, that's the Ninth Circuit in 2016, specifically rejected this as a permissible solution, stating if a total ban on internet use is improper, but a more narrowly tailored restriction would be justified, the solution is to have the district court itself fashion the terms of that narrow restriction. Thank you, Your Honors. I see I'm out of time.
Thank you, Counsel. Great. Thank you, Counsel, for your arguments. This matter will stand submitted.